Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big MX Radio Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Moose Off-Road. If you're not familiar, you should be. They've been around forever, and they support the sport like no other. They're all over the GNCC series, whether it's four wheels or two wheels. They support a ton of teams, including that Landers KTM team. I am your host, Brad Gebhardt. With me on the line is a man that I've been wanting to have on the show for a long period of time. A guy I grew up looking up to, even though we're about the same age anyway. He certainly had a whole lot more speed than I do. Some people connect him with a saying like, don't mess with Texas. More people probably think of him as a guy from Kansas. We're going to get to the bottom of it. Tommy Hahn, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad. Appreciate it.
Hey, appreciate you coming on, and I have an appreciation for the distance between us right now because that means there's no chance of me putting a dip of long cut into my lip and then ending up having to visit the restroom shortly thereafter. What's going on in your world?
Just wide open. Coaching kids. We do this. I do it from underground, the underground facility here in Kemp, Texas. We've been blessed with a good winter so far. Always kind of cringe if we make it into February and we still have nice weather. That usually means March and April are going to be not spring like conditions. So, yeah, we had a bad week last week. It was a little rainy and we did have an ice storm. It took off. We got everything good. The track's been killer this week. And it's going to be 80 degrees next week again. So, can't complain. We got a good group of kids and a good group of families here. So I'm stoked. It's just wide open, a lot of work.
So for those who aren't familiar, I myself have never had the pleasure of going down and riding in Texas. And maybe next winter we need to do something about that. What's the Texas motocross landscape in the months of December, January, February? The rest of the country's pretty cold, but you guys, like, for the most part, it's rideable weather, lots of training going on, and as we spoke off air, you've got a number of athletes under your wing and tutelage, dropping the lap times and getting that throttle therapy.
Yeah, it's a real strong – we have a real strong winter series down here. A lot of people come from everywhere to race it. We host one of the races here at the track at Underground. And I believe there's five tracks or something, but I want to say we had over 700 entries at the winter series race here. And I know every race has been anywhere from 5 to 8. So, Billadilla, which is a beautiful track, just about 45 minutes from here, they're hosting the race this weekend. And I'm sure that one will do good as well. And, you know, there's other series too, competing series. They're not usually on the same weekend, so that makes it easy. You can ride them all, but we're still having night practice. We're having night practice right now as we speak. So the weather is good enough. We can keep doing that stuff.
That's rad. So tell me a little bit about Underground. The track's been there for a long period of time. They do host some pretty high-profile races. And being able to train at a place like that, that's got to give your students a little bit of a leg up on the competition when the rest of the hot shoes come in and race that track.
Yeah, we don't train on the racetrack so much. Maybe a couple days, maybe 1 week out of the month we'll get on the racetrack, but we have a really good training track right behind it, and Jeremy Brown, the track organizer, and myself come up with ways to switch it up as much as we can and just keep the kids riding something relatively new most of the week. At least, you know, at least once a month we're changing something, or even, you know, sometimes more than that. And you know, Jeremy's a very, very good dozer operator. He's a wizard, so whatever we kind of come up with, he knocks out in an afternoon or something. So it's a great facility. I used to come here, my brother and I both used to come here, I think starting in 06. It was Kyle Riegel's practice track. His dad Mark did everything. He was awesome in equipment, and I lived on the other side of Metroplex, so it was 2 hours 15 minutes for us to get here. Sometimes Will and I would come consecutive days. The drive sucked, but It was such a good place. The dirt is so good here. And then after, you know, Regal's family sold it, Randy Poulter, really good track builder, he turned it into what it is now. And man, every time I swing a leg over a bike out here, it's like riding in heaven. It's awesome.
So how often do you still throw a leg over the bike and get some throttle therapy of your own? Do you keep the skills pretty sharp, or are you a shell of the rider you once were?
I'd love to lie and say yes, but no, I haven't rode for a little bit. I am currently trying to figure out something with a bike right now. Definitely a blue bike. So we'll get that figured out. I'd like to do 25 and 40 either this year or next year at Loretta's. I just want to make sure that I'm prepared for it. It'll just help me help the kids once we're there, because, you know, unless I'm riding it, I mean, I can see things and I can tell them and I can suggest, and I do have experience, so I do know the feeling, but unless you're really out there, you just don't always know. So, yeah, I'd like to do that more. I stay in good shape. I still eat really well. I'm not gaining weight. I've actually lost weight since when I was racing. So, I guess I have it pretty good.
Fair enough. So your last season that you raced competitively in Supercross was 2018, correct?
17.
And that was with Rock River Yamaha, number 85?
Yep.
There you go. So with your training, what portion of it is like, and sort of how do you approach the demonstration side of things? If you're not riding on a regular basis or you don't have a bike of your own, how do you execute like stuff like that? Do you take like a star pupil out of the group that might be getting the concept a little better than some of the other riders and use them as the demonstrator, or how do you go about it?
Yeah, that's what I'll do. Or I'll just kind of over explain, not try to confuse them or anything, but I'll over explain certain things and tell them what they should be feeling. And most of the time that works really well, but yes. Yeah. Then I'll take somebody that's doing that section or that obstacle very well. And I'll make them watch just to see how it's done. And, you know, monkey see, monkey do with a lot of these kids nowadays. So yeah, that's the way I'll do it. With the little bikes, it's probably better that a pupil's doing it rather than a big bike, 'cause it's just completely different.
Right.
So, but with the big bike riders, I wish I was out there with them, and some of them think they're pretty good too. So I'd really like to, calm down the noise a little bit.
Yeah.
Cause they are teenagers and they're cocky. So I would like to, get out there and show them what an old man can do.
Fair enough. And you would know, what being a cocky teenager is like. You yourself were a hot up and coming, athlete in your own right. Same thing with your brother for that matter. Like, do you think that there was more sort of fanfare and sort of buzz around sort of your brother's transition to the pros, or do you think there was more buzz around, your pro debut?
I don't know, but like, with when I came through and in my last year at Loretta's, like there was maybe three of us, I think, that got rides, three or four maybe, but not all of us went to high profile rides. I think I got the most high profile ride. So maybe that made created more noise. And with Will's graduating class, there were four legit guys in there that went to factory teams. And I think Will was the one that he ended up going to Star when, you know, Star was still building the blocks.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I did go straight to Geico. It was Amsoil Honda then. And just had a good year at Loretta's. I ended up with one title. Probably should have had two, but I can't be mad at it. My good buddy Ryan Sipes won the other one. So, and we both went on to do good things.
Yeah, and now both also passing on your knowledge to the next generation. Like guys that you sort of came up with, that sort of 125 A class, like that's the Jacob Saylors of the world. That's the Nick Evenews of the world. Adam Chatfield, if you want to go head across the pond to the UK. Those are some hotly contested championships. We're talking Loretta's 2004 125 A class. Those are some really, really deep, classes full of talent. Like, as an athlete, especially coming from Kansas, how did you sort of set yourself out of the herd and sort of kind of set yourself apart aside from just lap times?
I'm really not sure, Brad. It all came so easy and just so like natural.
Okay.
I don't know. I just did what I did. Like I lined up. I had confidence going into my last year. Like I had won Mammoth a couple months before that and beat some really high names there. Some guys that already had good rides and stuff like that. So I don't know. I knew that I was not going to leave Loretta's without a title that year. Granted, any bike failures, which I had a bike failure in one in the very first moto of the week. But the rest, the last five went great. I don't know. I just told myself, hey, this is what I'm going to do. And maybe my dad just pissed me off enough each time to make me go out there and want to prove him wrong too or something. I don't know, but it came really easy. And before I knew it, I had a ride with Geico and, I told myself at the beginning of the year, that's where I wanted to end up. Because there were talks from the year before. I had a really strong start to Loretta's the year before, but just had a bunch of bike failures. And I raced Millsaps that year. That was his graduating year. And should have won the first A-class moto, 125A, and bike blew up. I was gone. And then had a pretty good couple motos after that on the 125. So there was some talk with teams then, and I think that's kind of what sparked the fire. It's like, okay, they know who I am, so now I need to go prove it.
Yeah, certainly. And you were also part of a graduating class of professional athletes that the sport that you grew up like competing for and looking towards, like when you were a bit of an on 80s, looking at what the pro class looked like, that is all two strokes. That is 250 two strokes in the premier class, 125 two strokes in the 125 class, I guess what is now called the 250 class. But then by the time it was your time and Millsap's time to transition into the pros, that's when four strokes started to take over. They were a competitive advantage in certain situations, but not always. And they did come with their issues. How did you sort of like handle that landscape of sort of transitioning onto the four strokes after also spending some time on two strokes? That's kind of like the only world we really knew. I'm of the same vintage, spending the first 2 years of my 125 or first year on big bikes, on 125s. How was that transition for you? And at what point did you sort of like, either whether it was with your dad or with a trainer, be like, hey, we're going to have to learn how to go fast on these four strokes because, the 125 is not cutting it.
The 125 or going from the 125 to the four stroke for me was like tough because I rev the absolute crap out of the bike and pop valves all the time, especially at the beginning. Even when I got to the team, like they were like, I blew up a lot of bikes, but we were also in a learning phase too. Like even, from like my dad and I doing it to when I went to the team, like it was still all whatever dad and I got done. It was all still kind of guessing because everybody was so new to them, you know, and they didn't quite know about the valve springs, and the different valves and the keepers and all that stuff to keep it together. So it was a hard transition. I liked the four strokes better because they had more power. But I was a good 125 rider. I was a good 252 stroke rider. I really wish I would have been able to be born a couple years later and got into the end of that on some good 125s because I never rode a badass 125 that was like from a team. So
yeah,
it would have been really cool to ride one of those and just see how good they were compared to what good amateur people would build. So the four stroke transition was tough. And I mean, I was always a better 450 rider. Well, in outdoors, I was a better 450 rider. In Supercross, I favored a 250 a little bit more because 450 is just too much for Supercross.
Yep.
But, it was tough, but we made it work and things worked out, I guess.
Certainly did. You did end up with a professional win. We'll get to that a little bit later. But let's spin the clock back a little bit further. Like you said, you get that championship in 2004 at Loretta Lynn's Amateur National Championships, the crown jewel of amateur racing in all of the world, basically. There's a lot of results that can be judged upon over a calendar year. Nothing more so than Loretta Lynn's. You grab a championship. And then, tell me a little bit about sort of switching gears from there and setting your sights on your very first national, which was Steel City, which is in Pennsylvania, if I'm not mistaken, 2004, September 5th. We used to race that far into the fall, believe it or not, when it comes to pro racing. We don't do that anymore. Tell me a little bit about Steel City, and then 1 week later being across the country racing at Glen Helen on a 250F.
It was very surreal. It happened so fast. Like I said, like I'm, you know, at my family home in Kansas. We go to Loretta's. I win Loretta's. I knew I was up for the ride because I had done a test, you know, probably before regional, sometime during the summer in California. I had done a test for Geico. And ultimately, they ended up taking Josh Grant at the beginning of the outdoors that year instead of me, which was kind of fine with me because I still had some unfinished business I wanted to take care of at Loretta's. Okay. And I'd blown a championship in 02 and basically lost a championship in 03, and I wanted to get at least one. Going to Steel City, like lining up, and of course I was in unseated practice the first time and I didn't know what to expect, and I had to do the qualifying motos on Saturday that they used to have because we had practice on Saturday, raced on Sunday. I won my qualifying moto against some pretty good dudes, and I was crazy. I wasn't known for getting good starts, and like I ripped a whole shot and just kind of walked away with it, and that gave me confidence going into Sunday. And then one of the practices on Sunday, I qualified like second or third, or my times were like second or third. I didn't qualify then. But one of my times were like second or third. And I was like, well, maybe I can do this. There was a lot of doubt I had too. Like this just cornbread farm kid from Kansas. So yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know that you were supposed to do motos to, you know, there wasn't none of these training facilities and all this information out back then. You know, I didn't know that I had to go do 30-minute motos. You know, I had first time at, that year at Loretta's was the first time I never got tired, so I figured I was in great shape. Second moto, I worked my way up to fifth, and man, did I ever find out what hitting the wall feels like. Like, I think I faded back to eighth. I went like 12-8 or something like that. I don't remember what my scores were, but overall, I walked away like proud. I kind of knew what to expect. And then 1 week later, Glen Helen was going much better. First moto, I think I was a seventh. And then bad big pileup in the second moto, and my bike got destroyed. So I didn't finish that one. But I left those two races like, all right, it's time. Like, I'm here. I belong here. Like, I have the speed to run with these guys. And then it was time to learn Supercross, which I had a Supercross track at home that, after West Coast the following year, when it went on break, I went home and rode and found out that it was fairly legit. So I just needed certain help on techniques because I didn't have anybody to teach me. So like how I hit the whoops and rolling your turns a little better, just stuff like that. It came pretty quick. So it was, like I said, it all came pretty easy and it happened so fast. So from that August to the beginning of October was like I'd lived three lifetimes again. It was crazy.
No kidding. And then you roll into your very first Supercross. And a lot of people have a lot of memories of this particular race. I don't know necessarily how much memory they have of Tommy Hahn at this particular race, but Anaheim won 2005. Like a lot of discussion about maybe the deepest 252 stroke premier class lineup that to ever exist. And then you had a young 17, if I'm not mistaken, year old Tommy Hahn getting fourth place behind Japanese rider Akira Narita. in your very first Supercross, fourth overall in the mud, ahead of Steve Lamson, ahead of Ryan Sipes, too, by the way, and also ahead of eventual champion Ivan Tedesco. Tell me a little bit about, that first Supercross, being under the lights, and that ultimately is what you're preparing these young athletes for now.
There was a lot of goosebumps and a lot of nerves. The mud definitely took some of the nerves out of it because I knew I was a good mud rider. But where the doubt came in with myself was I had never rode mud in Supercross. And people, like, at first I was like, I'm a good mud rider. I don't care. That's fine. And then people were like, well, you've never rode a Supercross track in the mud. And I'm like, well, how different could it be? And it's different, but luckily I was still pretty good at it. And yeah, just two things that stand out to me about that race is letting Akira Narita get by me in the last two laps. Like, that dude just went full kamikaze. Like, I don't know. I couldn't ride like him. Like, it was crazy. And the second one was passing Ivan Tedesco and knowing that when he saw me pass him, that he just held the throttle wide open and fell. So that he told me there's no way that kid just passed me, and he said he just pinned it and then ended up falling. So
you got in his head.
I did. I still am.
Text
really.
Text hot sauce right now to confirm.
No. He's the fact of that matter is he's still riding Supercross at 45 and ripping, and I will not touch a Supercross track. So,
That's interesting because your brother was on Pulp maybe a month ago and was saying he loves riding Supercross. He's going to keep that as sharp as it can be for as long as it can be. Why the dichotomy of opinions on that?
If you're not racing, what's the point? I know it's
fun. Pretty rad. Like, yeah, not going to lie to you. It's pretty sweet. Chicks probably dig it.
Well, in your 40s, they don't give a shit about that anymore.
Well, they never truly, truly did. But perhaps what the riding the Supercross did for the wallet, that might have helped. But
no, yeah, that definitely helped. But I don't know. I just have no ambition to ride Supercross. I like railing a perfect rut, or that's how I know I'm old now, because I enjoy turns better than I do jumps. And I like the technical outdoor tracks.
That is early onset vet rider.
Yeah. Like, I had that mentality at 32. Like, when I retired, I was like, no, I'm never going to ride Supercross again. That's a weight off my shoulders. So, and plus, you got to pay you got to spend the money on a bike. Like, you have to have the right equipment to go out on the Supercross track. You know, the more legit that they are, the better your bike really needs to be. And you can't cut any corners there. And when a team's not footing the bill, that's hard to have, two, three, four bikes to be able just to enjoy some Supercross. Now, Will's cheating because he just has a team and he can just jump on Justin Cooper, any of the 250 kids' bikes.
Yeah.
So that's cheating to me.
Right. He's not even doing it fair. He's cheating. I mean, we should need to hold his feet to the fire a little bit more on that. So sort of getting back to your current role as a trainer and a mentor for these young athletes, you've gone through that transition on a number of different things, moving from 65, you did race the 65 at Loretta's, moving up through the different sizes of bikes and the transitions that's necessary there, as well as, moving on from a little bike to a big bike, which it sounds like it's an easy transition for a lot of athletes, but it really isn't for some as well. How do you sort of manage that as well as the fact that you yourself, you're training a kid Shannon Tarnow, who other than Loretta's, although even at Loretta's, he did a lot of winning. These kids, they don't come to the finish line outside of the top five too often. How do you sort of keep those kids grounded and continuously working towards that next level, knowing that it is in fact there, while also working with an athlete that's pretty accomplished in their own right?
It's funny. A lot of the kids, even as young as Shannon is, and Tate Brush has been here for a few weeks, and he won the other class that Shannon won. So Shannon won the stock class and Tate won the mod class.
No big deal.
And they're best friends and they just feed off of each other. So, I mean, they're neck and neck every time they go out onto the track. I make them swap. One goes in front of the other and they alternate. It's crazy because even at that age, they know what they need to do. They know when they need to be grounded. They know when they can be kids. You know, they need reminded every now and then, but ultimately it makes my job easy because they're so focused on in where they want to go that they just know what they need to do. And they listen very well. You know, I think the better they are, the better they listen. So far in my experience. But yeah, I mean, I even see that with the schoolboy, like some of my schoolboy riders and B riders. So they are focused. They know what the end goal is and they do the things that it takes to get there. Whereas in my day, you know, you worked a lot off of talent. And if you knew you had the talent, you didn't always know what tools you needed. But if you had the talent, that was a big portion of it. Now, these kids have the talent and all the rest of the tools. So they just know that, hey, I've done my work. And then when they line up to the gates in these big races, I've done my work and nobody hears better than me. So it's pretty cool to see that different aspects from when I was amateur and helping my brother, even when he was amateur. So.
Certainly. And I think you could sort of speak to, the situation of having a younger brother who is coming up through as well. I'm sure there were some lessons learned on your behalf, with some of the just sort of like, not to say mistakes, so to speak, but just like the trials and tribulations of being a hot young amateur racer that's moving up through. Tell me a little, like, could you sort of shed some light on some of the things that maybe your brother benefited from as far as just like the, moving through that system where like you were sort of the leader in all of that. You know what I mean? You're obviously the older brother. And Will, like you both had a lot of success as pros. Of course, he gets the championship and all that as well. But like, is there at times the younger brother, gets a little bit of, like you're trailblazing for him and he was the benefit of that?
Yeah. I mean, Will was smart. So like he was smart. If I messed up or did something and I knew I wasn't supposed to do that or was finding out I wasn't supposed to do that, he automatically picked up on it. And a lot of the times, you know, you wouldn't even have to tell him. Like he just knew I'm not doing that. But at the same time, we were such different riders that maybe sometimes something that doesn't work for me does work for him and vice versa. So, you know, he was smart. He was smart but he listened too. And, you know, we did what we could, especially his last few years, amateur. He was getting good deal from Honda and I was just helping any way that I could to make sure whatever he had. And, you know, mom and dad, they weren't out of the picture. They were still going to races and stuff, but they, you know, there was really nothing coming out of their pocket anymore. They were just kind of along for the ride and, you know, just there to support him and hope that he gets what he wanted. And, from the moment I got sponsored, I got the Amsoil ride. That's where he always wanted to be. Like he wanted to be a Geico rider and he, in his own respect, he made it work. It just didn't happen as easily as it did for me. So, he started at Star and went to MDK and TLD and, he had a little bit of a rocky road there, but ultimately he made it, and did well. So, yeah, I think Will was smart. If I screwed up or dad got mad at me or I pissed dad off, whatever, he just knew not to do it. So, yeah, I guess you're welcome, Will.
Fair enough. So when it came to testing the limits of dad, you were the trailblazer, at least to figure out where that line is. Just getting back to your professional career, you did get a win, 2009 Steel City, the location of your very first pro race. You end up going 1-4 for the overall And that must have been the last race, if not close to the last race of the season. Take us through that a little bit. Like, it was a successful season for you overall. What do you remember about the 2009 season and getting that that race win?
I feel like people always kind of put an asterisk next to that win because Villopoto and a couple other people weren't there. But I mean, I still had to beat Reed,
I mean,
Villopoto, Short, Tedesco.
Yeah, Villopoto's not, he's hurt that year.
He did his ACL in between Glen Helen and Hangtown, I think.
Yeah.
I remember he came out and won Glen Helen, like came from way behind and passed Alessi or something like that. He won Glen Helen, went 1-1. And at Glen Helen, I believe I was fifth or sixth overall. I can't remember, but I either went 6-5 or 7-6 with everybody there. And that was my rookie 450 year, and Glen Helen was my first race. And I was nervous. I didn't know where I was going to be. I qualified 29th in practice, and I felt like I was riding amazing. I'm like, well, this is not going to be good. But ended up, you know, once the gate dropped, everything was fine. But yeah, there was a lot of uncertainty going into that series as well. It just, and Supercross wasn't real good for me my first year on 450. I got hurt in December at the test track. Pretty good. I messed up my back pretty bad, broke my hand, and it took me a while to get back. So I didn't ride again until almost February, and then came in at like, I don't know, A3 or something right before the series went east. Kind of unprepared, but okay. I just wanted to get back to racing. And I built confidence throughout the year, but I don't remember what my best finish was. Maybe a seventh or an eighth, where the year before I was getting top five, you know, in the 450 class. So, that part sucked. But yeah, going into the outdoors, it was just like I knew I was a good 450 rider, and I knew I was good outdoors, and I hadn't really shown that much promise. Like I had flashes in the 250 class outdoors, but you just had to ride the 250 back then. So I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. Just awfully, like, I don't know. I don't even know how to say it. You had to be an animal. You just had to ride it so fast.
You had to wring its neck.
Yeah, you had to wring its neck everywhere. You had to ride it so fast, you couldn't make a mistake. You had to be so perfect on it. Whereas the 450 gave you time to think, and you could, you know, you could lug it and, you know, still make time on people. I don't know. I just knew I was good on the 450, and I could do good that series. And I did. We had a couple bad motos, but
for the most part, I was just looking at it here. I'm looking at your vault right now. You had two results outside the top 10. There was a 12th at Freestone. I assume that you probably had some weird moto scores there. Yeah, a 35.5. So probably that should have been another top 10 for you. And then obviously a 30th at a different round. Otherwise, all top 10s, including a fourth right before you ended up winning it at Steel City. So like, yeah, you were completely legit. And was that the Motorsport Kawasaki? Like, is that the like Cannon Day bike, or what is that?
Yeah, it was a Cannon Day dog foods bike.
There you go.
That company was awesome. They were really cool. That bike was good. Like, we had a lot of help from Mitch that year, and that was the first year of the fuel injected 450. So, and the better that I did, the more kind of parts started trickling in from, say, Mitch and Factory Cali. So that bike was freaking good. I got spoiled my first year on 450 for sure.
So, okay, take me through a situation like that. Like 2009 outdoors, you start out with a sixth, a ninth, a 12th, but that, like I said, the 12th is a 35 and a five. How does Mitch Payton, or I guess who would it have been at? Was it Roy Turner at Kawasaki at the time? Like, how do they reach out? Do they reach out to the team? Do they reach out to you? Do you have an agent at the time? And then how does it go about, like, those parts ending up showing up and going on your motorcycle?
I think it was just part of my results. Like, my results started getting better, and especially after Freestone. Like I want to say Freestone, I DNF'd the first moto, and I think it's because a rock went through my radiator. And I want to say it was either that or 2010 when that happened. I can't remember. But no, I just, somebody asked me a question, like a team manager would ask me a question, and I would say, hey, they'd be like, what would you improve on the bike right now? And my first thing that I ended up getting, I was like, I said, I could really use a front brake, like a better front brake. And I believe Cowie gave me the factory Nissan brake, you know, the next race. And then it was other little parts, just some internal stuff. And that wasn't really necessarily me asking. It was, you know, Mitch and our team manager, Bill Keefe, and our engine guy, like them working together, knowing like, hey, and then also new bike, newer parts are coming later, you know, stuff like that. And development is getting better throughout the year. So we're just, you know, trying different things and seeing what worked. But yeah, I think I may have had a good frame on my bike, a good frame and swing arm at one point too. Maybe to begin with outdoors, or maybe got it after a couple of races. I don't know. The bike I started with and the bike I ended with was like two completely different bikes. I could tell you that.
Fair enough. So like throughout that year, like you're sitting on the line, and that must instill more and more confidence in yourself. Like, you know what you were capable of the bike you started with. And by round six, round seven, round eight, you're looking down and you're like, well, this thing's pretty capable. Like, I'm only going to be able to do better. And I guess that sort of is how it worked out with your season. You sort of like crescendoed to the end, and it culminated with a win at the very end of the season. That must have put a ton of wind in your sails rolling into 2010, which, if I'm not mistaken, was the year that you were running number 10. I believe so. Yeah, 2010.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Aboard, that's not factory Suzuki. That was Rockstar Suzuki.
Yeah, that was the same team. We just switched to Suzuki.
And
Rockstar came aboard. Canada was still a sponsor. But yeah, we were Rockstar Suzuki, Canada. I don't know. Yeah, I can't remember what the official team name was. And yeah, the Suzuki was a really good supercross bike because I started in supercross. I didn't even ride any outdoors on it. And we waited a long time. I remember it was like November before we got bikes. So I was just riding Kawasaki's at home. I had bought one that way I could keep riding, because obviously I had to give team bikes back.
Right.
And it sounded like we were going to be on Kawasaki as far as I knew. And then kind of last minute, we went to Suzuki, and yeah, the Suzuki was a good supercross bike. I had some troubles with some chain snapping, in the preseason, like on my birthday. So that's in December.
Mm.
I just got my top supercross track built at my house. I got back after doing initial testing and everything in California, and first day with my practice bike mechanic, who went to school to work. He's a childhood friend that went to school to work on bikes, and then he became my practice bike mechanic. And first day, and my chain snaps on three tabletops in a row. So it was on, and it snapped on the second one. And that I should have got really hurt in that crash, and somehow I didn't. I mean, I got hurt, but not like I should have. And then I had another one snap back in California when we were about a month later, when we were testing a certain part. We might've been testing with Pro Circuit. I don't remember, but I had another one snap on and on off. And so I was very gun shy through most of that Supercross series. Any on off that I jumped onto, I was just like a ball of nerves, like cringed up, like it sucked. So yeah, that was a good team. We looked amazing that year. Our kits were the best,
That's One Industries, correct?
Yeah, it was One Industries, head to toe. And then just our bikes and everything looked amazing. But yeah, the Suzuki was a good supercross bike. It was slow outdoors. I struggled with power. It was a great handling bike. I mean, the thing, I could toss that thing around so easy. And I was very strong in 2010. Like, I had really worked hard in the gym.
Still got a fourth at Washougal.
Yeah, it should have been a third. I threw away the first moto. It was my first moto score, like a six.
7-3. Yeah. Should have been podium.
Yeah. I freaking crashed. Yeah, I was in third. So it should have been a 3-2. That was where the power was coming in that I was talking about against those Hondas that year, because those Hondas were fast.
Yeah, horsepower hill. You beat Ryan Sipes again that day.
I did. Okay.
It's a reoccurring theme of the podcast. that's too funny. So with you working with young athletes, and I'm sure you work with a pretty wide range, but what would you say is the overarching theme as far as like what you hope that young athletes get out of working with you as a whole or one particular session? What is it you try to instill in your athletes that they're going to get the most out of and ultimately help them be better racers, but also better people?
Just safer and smoother riders. That's what I hope they get out of, just safer and smoother. You know, safe is good and smooth is fast. And then I tell all the boys, I got some teenagers and they have, you know, they like to cuss and stuff like that. And I tell them that if I ever catch them cussing in front of women or the moms or even, you know, girls their age, I said, you're going to find out that I don't take very good to that. So, I mean, and I'm not innocent. I have a mouth on me too. But when you're that young, you know, and you're at a training facility, there's a lot of people around and, you know, it's like living in a tiny village. So things get around very fast.
Oh yeah.
Your reputation precedes you. So act like a man and be a man. And I tell my 10-year-olds that. So, but like I said, I don't have to preach very hard. I have a good, real good set of families here. So, and you know, I'm not a tattletale. No, I won't usually rat them out to their parents, but if it's bad enough, I'll have to say something. So luckily I haven't had to do that yet.
Fair enough. He works with an iron fist over there in Texas. Where can people find out more information about Hon MX training? I know you've been working at this for a number of years now, being able to pass on your knowledge. Where can people find out more information and ultimately find their way to be able to work with you?
My Instagram at HonMX. And then you can go to UGMX.com or UGMX. Is it UGM? I should know this. I think it's UGMX.com.
I believe so. Yeah.
Undergroundcompound.com.
Yeah. Underground Compound on Instagram. That's where all the links, they've got you linked in there as well. Han_MX for training. And, I can't wait to see, some of your athletes, turn a wheel at Loretta Lynn's. That's sort of where it all sort of culminates every single season. But you've got a pretty busy calendar up until then. Like you said, Texas Winter Series, the Texas Amateur Nationals will be kicking off soon. I assume you'll be at Springending and stuff like that as well, or what's the plan there?
Yeah, definitely. I know a lot of my kids are gonna be going to the Spring Nationals this year, as well as the JS7 one. And then I'll be at a couple areas and regionals. And then before we know it, we're back at the ranch. So the only one I don't go to is Mini-O's, is just because I don't like going to that race. I didn't like racing it, and there's too many people packed in one place.
Yes, that is the sentiment that I hear more often than not. And, myself, I always end up heading to, Mesquite MX for their Thanksgiving Classic. If I'm going to be anywhere watching football, eating turkey and dirt bikes mixed in, it's going to be at Mesquite MX for their Thanksgiving Classic. Highly recommend. I think, fellow Texan, the Beckham and Breck, and is it Beckham and Bryson? Bryson Smith?
Yeah, Bryson.
Bryson, yeah, those kids yep. Came up last year. So maybe circle that one on the calendar. A lot less congested, but just as much fun.
Okay, I'll have to take that into consideration.
Certainly do it. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast, Tommy. You're going to have to be a repeat offender. Maybe we even toss on your brother here at some point. But I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Awesome, dude. You have yourself a great rest of your day. Don't hang up just yet. For podcast sake, we're going to cut things off right there.